welcome you all to Bligh Street for the 2014 Lowy Institute Media Award. Can I particularly welcome some of my board directors tonight, Mark Ryan, Jim Spiegelman and Michael Thorley. Can I welcome Malcolm Turnbull, the Communications Minister, our keynote speaker for the evening, as well as members of our judging panel whom I'll introduce soon. Thank you all for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, we established this award last year for two reasons. The first is that my colleagues and I are hungry consumers of news and opinion about Australia's place in the world. We're also frequent producers of it. In the last 11 years, my colleagues have published over 400 research papers and written over 1,000 op-eds for Australian and international publications. I know the board directors will be paying attention to that line in particular. They are sought-after commentators, quoted regularly in print, online, and on radio and television. The Interpreter, our brilliant online magazine edited by Sam Roggeveen, is recognised as one of the world's liveliest forums for debate on international policy. Just last week, actually, I got a text message from a friend who was in, I think I can say, in the Foreign Minister's office, and he said, I'm looking over two staff members' shoulders at the moment, and both of them are looking at the Interpreter. So it's very well read. And in turn, we get much of our information and intelligence from the media. You could say that we have a vested interest in having as much coverage of international issues in the Australian press as possible. But I also think that Australia has a vested interest in it, and this brings me to the second reason why we established the award. It seems to us that the breadth of Australian media coverage of international news is faltering at a time when we need Australian eyes on the world. This is a time of enormous change. The tyranny of distance is being replaced by the predicament of proximity, in which our new economic opportunities come with new political risks, in which we are closer to the world's booming markets, but also closer to the world's developing crises. We are less isolated, but also less insulated. And these changes will affect us all. Yet it seems to us that the media's coverage of international news has never seemed more precarious. We see bureaus being closed, we see journalists being made redundant. I note that while all the commercial TV networks cover the British royal family slavishly, for example, not one of them has a full-time correspondent in Beijing. So last year we launched the Media Award. And since then, there's been some good news. There have been some brilliant stories by Australian journalists which have occupied our judges. But there's also been bad news. Late last year, AAP closed its Port Moresby bureau, claiming that Australian newspapers weren't running enough of their stories. And yet PNG is a country of crucial importance to Australia. It's a country on which this institute will soon publish a very important paper. And of course we see the ABC and other news organisations rationalising their international network. Ladies and gentlemen, we passionately believe at the Institute that we cannot rely on the homogenised worldview of international news services. We don't just want to get our news from the New York Times website, excellent though it is. We need Australian journalists with Australian sensibilities alive to Australian interests to describe and interpret international events for Australian audiences. Let me say too that if foreign coverage in this country is getting thinner, the debate at home is getting flatter. And this is my personal homily, I guess. It does seem to me that much of our international debate in this country, or too much of it anyway, is deeply unserious. And let me cite one example. The unsettling and odd debate between 2008 and 2012 about Australia's campaign to win a seat on the UN Security Council. I don't know of any other serious country where this question would have produced a debate like the one we had. It would be obvious to most that a country such as Australia would, every quarter century or so, seek a seat at the top table. And I found, and this is a personal comment, not an institute view, I found the critics' focus on the relatively insignificant costs of a campaign for the Security Council revealed a depressingly small opinion of Australia's possibilities. Did the sceptics really take such a straitened view of our role in the world that they cavilled at the cost of running a diplomatic campaign. Now, events since the despicable shooting down of MH17 have demonstrated that the world matters to us, and also that it surprises us. One minute you are focused on the East China Sea, and the next minute there are Australian Federal Police inspecting a dangerous crash site in a war zone in eastern Ukraine. I believe that the government's response to MH17 has shown that Australia can be a player in world affairs, not a commentator, and I applaud them for the way the government comported itself in the aftermath of the downing of MH17. But I think everyone can also now see why that campaign for the Security Council seat was so important to our national interest. Now, I know that some have been quick to point out that some of our MPs opposed that campaign, but can I also recall in this room to this audience that many columnists and many commentators were also against it? I think we can do better, and that's why we inaugurated the Lowy Institute Media Award last year as a modest contribution towards thickening that debate, towards bringing realism to that debate, to stripping ideology out of that debate, to ensuring that our journalists remain on the global beat and producing quality stories about serious topics. We think it's imperative that they do so. Ladies and gentlemen, we want to see Australian journalists who work on international issues recognised for their effort, and we want to recognise their excellence as well as their effort. That's what this evening is about. But let me just say, if there are rewards, and indeed awards, for journalists working overseas, there are also risks. And in the past year, we have seen a dramatic illustration of this, with the arrest and the imprisonment and the sentencing to 7 years in prison of Peter Gresta in Egypt, along with his two Egyptian colleagues, Mohamed Fahmeh and Baha Mohamed. Peter Gresta may not have been working for an Australian news outlet, but he embodies many of the qualities that make Australian journalists so sought after by international media companies such as Al Jazeera. I believe it is important that we do not forget Peter Gresta, who was imprisoned, arrested, and sentenced for doing nothing more than his job. And tonight, I'm very pleased to say that his brother, Andrew Gresta, is here with us, and we're very grateful that he's accepted our invitation to join us this evening. We thought it fitting that a member of the Gresta family be here as a reminder that even as we celebrate the work of Australian journalists reporting out in the world, we also remember the very real risks that they take out in the world. Andrew, I think all of us here tonight admire the tremendous dignity and fortitude shown by your parents and your family, and we all hope that Peter's imprisonment and your family's ordeal will soon be over. It's my great pleasure now to introduce our keynote speaker for this evening, Malcolm Turnbull. I invited Malcolm to deliver the keynote address for this, the second Lowy Institute Media Award, for three reasons. First of all, of course, he's the Minister for Communications. He has portfolio responsibility for these areas as the Minister responsible for the ABC and media regulation and other important matters of state. Secondly, he is someone who is a great consumer of media and a nimble user of technology. It turns out he even understands metadata, which not all of us do. Unlike most of us, he understands the economics of technology. He was famously an early investor in Aussie Mail. And finally, Malcolm is a former journalist. He's been many things, an investment banker, a barrister, many things, but also a journalist. In his days at Oxford, I understand Malcolm wrote for The Bulletin and the London Sunday Times, as well as reporting for 2SM and Channel 9. He was never a foreign correspondent, as he said to me, but he does know how to spin a yarn and meet a deadline. So please join me in welcoming Malcolm Turnbull, MP, to the lectern.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's a great honour to be in the presence of so many distinguished journalists and foreign correspondents. And without singling out any one of the guests, may I acknowledge Andrew Gresta, whose brother Peter is imprisoned in Egypt after a trial that was no more than a shocking mockery of justice, as Hayden Cooper so brilliantly chronicled for the ABC. Peter Grester is a great Australian journalist who was simply doing his job, but had the bad luck to be working for a news organisation whose owners are regarded as political opponents of the Egyptian regime. Our government has condemned this decision to imprison Peter, not least because it was part of a broader attempt to silence a free press. Our Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, has met with her Egyptian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry, as recently as last month to argue for Peter's release. An appeal has been lodged, or will be lodged, and our officials will continue to provide every assistance to Peter and his family. We're often reminded that our freedoms, our way of life, are secured because our defence forces are prepared to put their lives on the line. We should not forget that the price of the news we read every day, of the transparency, accountability, indeed the democracy that only a free press can ensure, is all too often paid in lives and liberty put at risk by journalists like Peter Grester. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in my youth, I was fascinated by journalism, by newspapers, radio and television. Not just because, like so many young men, I was easily bored and naturally attracted to anything that meant I did not need to concentrate on one topic for too long. The romance of news, the adventure, the power and influence were all intoxicating. I remember returning home from a hiking expedition in Tasmania in 1972 and spending a night in Melbourne, my very first. I remember going with my friends to Young and Jackson's to admire Chloe and drink beer in pints. And then late in the evening, we went down to the Age Building, still owned by an independent David Simon company and edited by Graham Perkin. And we lay on the footpath to feel the thunder of the presses as they shook the street, and a few hours the whole city, as the news of the day roared out on a fleet of trucks. My great hero in those days was Harold Evans, the editor of the London Sunday Times. And of course, his great hero, of whom he often spoke, was Nick Tomalin, the foreign correspondent killed by a Syrian missile during the Yom Kippur War in 1973. I first met Evans not long after that at the Cambridge Union in 1975. He was one of the guest speakers, and I'd spoken later from the floor in the debate. A little after my speech, I was handed a note on Sunday Times letterhead: "Come and see me in the Gray's Inn Road if you want to be a journalist." And it was signed by Harold Evans. It was a summons from God. When I met Evans the next morning, he urged me to drop my legal studies and concentrate on journalism. He was very persuasive, and he summed his argument up like this: "If you become a lawyer, you will make much more money than you will as a journalist, but you will be bored out of your wits. You might become a judge, more boring still." Or, and at this point his voice dropped ominously, "Worse still, you could become a politician." He didn't need to elaborate on that dread prospect. My own efforts as a foreign correspondent were not distinguished, but I did have a few adventures. In 1974, my trusty Olivetti portable financed my travels through the United States, including a visit to Montgomery, Alabama. I was shocked to see that the flag of the United States was barely present, flown only from federal buildings like post offices. Everywhere else they flew the Confederate flag and the state flag of Alabama. It was like a different country. The governor was still George Wallace, and I managed to crash a press conference he was holding and then secure an interview with him. We canvassed his future plans, a possible joint ticket with Ronald Reagan, and the prospects of young Jimmy Carter. In his wheelchair, he still radiated a menacing strength as he told me that everything I had read about the South was wrong and everything was different in Alabama. So when he proposed to appoint me a lieutenant colonel in the Alabama State Militia, I felt it wise not to decline. I was, you'll understand, a long way from home. Later, when I was at university at Oxford, I continued to work as a journalist, stringing for Packers ACP, including the Bulletin and the Women's Weekly. Harold Evans forgave me for going back to law school and gave me a job on the Sunday Times. In those days, the Australian media companies had a substantial presence in London. Packers Australian Consolidated Press not only had an office on Ludgate Circus at the end of Fleet Street, but their chief correspondent had a fine company house in the West End and a driver. And the Fairfax establishment was even grander, as I recall. Those were the days. Next door on Fleet Street was the Art Deco magnificence of the Daily Express building, immortalised in private eye as the Black Lubyanka, and the columns of the Daily Telegraph building built to convey a message, an unequivocal message of money and power, and of course still doing so, but now, alas, is the home of Goldman Sachs. The world of which I reminisce is not so long ago in years from us today, but a galaxy, or should I say an iPhone away, in so many other ways. In those days, an Australian abroad would find nothing about Australia in the local press, apart from the cricket scores, and then only if you were in a cricketing country. Australians at home learned about the rest of the world exclusively through the Australian media. Today, this is utterly changed. The internet and the smartphone mean that most people in the developed world, and soon most people in the whole world, will be able to connect with each other 24/7. Australians can read the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times as easily as they can read their local papers. Social media offers an avalanche of news. It seems that the modern warrior has a gun in one hand and a smartphone in the other, tweeting and Facebooking his opponents and often, as we have seen so appallingly this week, his own atrocities. It is a far cry from the world of Evelyn Waugh's Scoop, when William Boot was sent off to Ishmaelia by Lord Copper of the Beast to cover what was hoped to be a war in Ishmaelia. What the British public wants, first, last, and all the time, is news, said Lord Copper. Remember that the Patriots are in the right and are going to win. The Beast stands by them four square, but they must win quickly. The British public has no interest in a war which drags on indecisively. A few sharp victories, some conspicuous acts of personal bravery on the Patriot side, and a colourful entry into the capital. That is the Beast policy for the war. We shall expect the first victory about the middle of July. Now, a recent feature on Indonesia's president-elect Joko Widodo, or Jokowi, by Fairfax correspondent Michael Bachelard, noted his favourite method for cutting down on corruption and exposing what's really going on in the bureaucracy by was conducting what is known in Bahasa as blukusan, the unannounced visit. At its most fundamental, that is also the job of the foreign correspondent, to be immersed in a foreign country, to speak to the elite certainly, but well beyond them, to test the official narrative and statistics against the lived experience, and to listen to those who would otherwise not be heard. The days of simply rewriting the local news are over. All of that is available instantly to your readers and editors back home. But getting access is especially hard for a foreign correspondent. Everywhere in the world, politics is local, and so is the media focus of the politicians. It's also always been expensive to maintain a foreign bureau, and that is even without William Boot's supply of cleft sticks. In an online world, the Fairfax correspondent in Washington or Tokyo is not just competing against a competitor from News Limited or the Wire Service, they're competing against every conceivable source of news, whether it is the New York Times, the FT, the Wall Street Journal, or the English language online edition of the Asahi Shimbun. The New York Times averages 50 million unique visitors to its website each month, of which 17 million, or 34%, are outside the United States. The Guardian has 40 million unique users visit its website each month, and a staggering 2/3 of them are outside of the UK. In June, The Guardian had 1.8 million unique viewers come to its site in Australia, more than visited the Daily Telegraph site. The BBC had more than 1.6 million unique viewers in Australia, more than the Courier Mail. The Huffington Post was barely edged out by The Australian, with 1.3 unique viewers, and the New York Times had 731,000. It is a global struggle for readers' attention. In the 1960s, the Herald and Weekly Times maintained five journalists in London, three in New York, full-time correspondents in Paris, Rome, Singapore and Rabaul, plus shared correspondents in Johannesburg, Tokyo, Toronto and New Delhi. Fairfax maintained large bureau in London and New York. Such an extensive foreign presence would be unheard of for a newspaper group today. In recent years, The Australian has closed its bureau in Washington, New York, Los Angeles, London, Bangkok and New Zealand, but still has correspondents in Jakarta, Beijing, Tokyo, Jerusalem, and of course a very extensive network of correspondents to draw upon from the wider News Corp stable. Fairfax has correspondents in Washington, London, Beijing, Delhi, the Middle East, and has reinstated Lindsay Murdoch in Southeast Asia based in Bangkok. Over the years, it's pulled out of Wellington, Tokyo, and New York. The Australian Financial Review no longer has a correspondent in Tokyo, our second largest trading partner. The ABC, I'm pleased to say, is the standout in this area, and so it should be, as our public broadcaster. As I've often said, the ABC, the public broadcaster, is more important than ever because of the constraints and pressures on the other great foundations of journalism, the great newspapers. The ABC has bureau in Washington, London, New Zealand, Jakarta, Beijing, Bangkok, Jerusalem, New Delhi, Tokyo, and stringers in many other locations. But all of it collectively is much diminished, as Michael said earlier, from what it was before. Now, some journalists and editors I've spoken to have mused whether foreign news is less important in the local media than it used to be. Not because Australians have lost interest in the rest of the world, that in fact has increased, but because there are so many other sources of foreign news available thanks to the internet. The vast volume of online news keeps us up to speed about what is happening anywhere and everywhere, but it does have limitations. There are places where the local media are not well informed and or not available online in English. Knowing what is going on in New York or London is easy, but what about Cairo or Aleppo, or closer to home, Hanoi, Taipei or Jakarta? It's noteworthy that The Australian no longer has a correspondent in London or New York, no doubt because it can rely on its sister publications in those centres, but it does keep a correspondent in Jakarta. And then there is context. What does news in a far-flung place mean for Australians? Of course, some of this context can be injected by seasoned and knowledgeable writers at home. The New York Times' Tom Friedman was one of the first to do this for the New York market, for the American market. And he has local counterparts like Greg Sheridan and Peter Hartcher, who's here with us tonight, who are based in Australia but read very widely, have a lengthy list of foreign contacts, and travel enough to keep those relationships and connections fresh. But there is one aspect of reporting on the rest of the world and putting information in an Australian context that I believe is underdone. And let me start with a little background. When I was first elected to Parliament nearly 10 years ago, one part of the policy debate I found quite striking was the lack of interest most policymakers in Canberra had in other countries' choices and outcomes. The same was largely true of the reporting of public policy in the press. Compare this to the business world, which has long necessarily been international, not just because of cross-border integration and the fact that so many businesses are global, but because we all appreciate that what works or sells in one market is very likely to work in another. These commonalities are more nuanced in public policy. Widely varying cultures, histories, and political and economic institutions are more influential. Nevertheless, the truth is that most policy challenges particular jurisdictions confront are not unique or unprecedented, whatever local politicians may say. Other policymakers have grappled with them or with very similar issues, and over time have tried different approaches yielding different results. The Australian media rarely reports how different countries have approached what are usually shared and very familiar issues that are topical in our country and also topical in others. And the little such reporting there was in the past has almost disappeared in the digital age. Think about the example of contemporary New Zealand. Now, New Zealand, I should say, is a country that I think, by and large, does most things more efficiently than Australia. My good friend, the New Zealand Prime Minister, John Key, explained this by saying, "We simply don't have the money to waste that you do." He said, we don't have any choice to be efficient. We've got to be lean. Now, in the 80s and 90s, 1980s and 1990s, there was at least a modest but useful flow of information about the radical economic reforms that transformed New Zealand from the most rigid, regulated capitalist economy in our part of the world to the most open and free, and the political convulsions that followed. Earnest young economics writers, Michael Stutchbury, now editor of the AFR, is here tonight, Alan Mitchell and Ross Gittins, would periodically be dispatched across the ditch by their editors to report back from the front line of economic reform. Now, over the past decade, New Zealand has faced many of the same policy challenges and far stiffer economic headwinds than Australia, and has started from a much weaker position. Yet the Kiwis have managed to deliver a far superior record of economic performance and reform since the GFC than Australia has, particularly under Prime Minister John Key. Since 2009, New Zealand has managed to execute significant tax reform, increasing their GST to 15% to shift their revenue mix towards indirect taxes, broadening the base, lowering the rates of direct taxes on personal and company income. The New Zealand budget has shifted from a deficit of 9.2% of GDP 4 years ago, twice as much red ink as Wayne Swan ever managed, to a surplus this year. And although the worst deficit year was distorted by the Canterbury earthquakes, New Zealand's fiscal consolidation since the GFC, most of it coming from curtailing spending, is one of the most exemplary in the developed world. Economic growth is forecast to exceed growth in Australia next year. Will be overtaken by the Kiwis. Economic policy success in New Zealand has received only the most cursory coverage in Australia. An analysis by the Australian Parliament's Library found that from 2009, only 15 articles in major Australian newspapers explored tax reform in New Zealand, and almost half were opinion pieces written by think tanks or lobby groups. Now, turning to another example, one of my favourites, broadband policy. The previous government made a commitment in 2007 to spend $4.7 billion to subsidise the upgrade of broadband infrastructure. That was not exceptional. Many, although far from all, advanced and emerging economies have done the same. But from 2009 onwards, as Bill Scales recently chronicled in his audit report, a series of extraordinary policy choices resulted in Australia tackling a familiar and shared problem, how to achieve widespread access to very fast broadband, with a policy of exotic uniqueness. No other country created a government-owned startup to deliver the upgrades. No other country is spending as much per premises for those upgrades. Most other countries are encouraging infrastructure-based competition rather than paying competitors with sunk costs to close down their fully functional networks. Broadband was, we were told, a vital issue at the last election. The Coalition had a comprehensive policy, which had been derived in large part from my research into what other countries were doing. In particular, I noted that considerable savings were made by not taking fibre into every premises as the Labor government had planned. Our fibre to the node approach was ridiculed and attacked as unworkable, out of date, a technological absurdity. So if this was the big issue, surely the international experience was relevant. Surely any level of journalistic curiosity would have caused an editor to send a reporter to interview British Telecom or AT&T or Deutsche Telekom about their experience. After all, the shadow minister kept on saying that they were deploying a policy that the coalition was proposing. And so I issued a challenge to journalists in our major media organisations, who do have the reporters and networks overseas to do the story justice, to do a comparison of what other countries were doing and what technologies were being deployed. You would think this would have been a relevant issue. In fact, it was the key issue on broadband. After 3 years of complaints, the only people actually to do an international comparison were not from the mainstream press at all. They were Phil Dobby and Josh Taylor, who write for the industry publications ComsDay and ZDNet. It's a great example of the failure to analyse and report on comparable policy responses to common problems. If there was one thing that we should aim to see more of in our media and in our general debate, is a greater awareness of what is happening in the rest of the world. We should, at least intellectually, get out more. Now, there is an argument that in a world where everyone has access to social media and Google, that foreign correspondents are no longer needed, that it's a relic that no longer reflects the reality of how news is gathered or what the economics of media organisations will allow. There is an issue that many, many journalists, particularly the senior ones, have raised with me, and there is a tendency, they say, particularly among their younger colleagues, to rely on Google rather than forging their own contacts and wearing out their shoe leather. There seems to be a resistance, they tell me, to pick up the phone and actually talk to people as opposed to look it up on the net. Now, the world has changed, and it would be foolish to think that digital platforms are useless when it comes to news gathering. And there is something admirable in the tradecraft that developed by generations of journalists who didn't source check their stories via the net. The term that has arisen to describe the reliance on social media for reporting and the flood of news on social media is enormous, unmanageable, is accidental journalism. That term, accidental journalism, has never seemed so apt. In tough economic conditions, when consumers have access to a deluge of information, credibility for media organisations is more important than ever, not less. I'm reminded of that sardonic quip by Morley Safer, the veteran CBS correspondent, when he said, "I would trust citizen journalism as much as I would trust citizen surgery." And it's worth noting that while Australian news organisations are pulling back from maintaining foreign bureau, most of the journalists I've spoken to are genuinely surprised at how many still remain, even though there have been deeper cuts elsewhere in the business. It was the world-weary English journalist Thomas Fowler and The Quiet American who summed up why you can't always rely on a writer popping in and out of a foreign country to tell their stories. "They say," he said, "you come to Vietnam and you understand a lot in a few minutes, but the rest has got to be lived." On returning from China, where he worked for 6 years with Fairfax, John Garneau wrote a beautiful piece about his time there. "Each night," John wrote, "my head reeled with the implications of information absorbed but not fully digested. Where was China going? Was I doing justice to the story and getting the balance right? Grey hairs appeared, the skin under my eyes grew darker, and I found myself jolted wide awake, bathed in sweat, in the pre-dawn hours each morning. With every road trip and each deep interview, I discovered afresh how little I'd known before." We all as citizens depend on John and his colleagues getting these stories right. And that is why it is such an honour to be here among you tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. We've had this dinner twice now, and we've had two magnificent lectures. In the first year, it was by Nick Warner, the Director General of the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, talking about his father, Dennis Warner, in a very moving and interesting speech. And now we've had a thoughtful and challenging speech from Malcolm Turnbull, urging us to get out more intellectually speaking. Thank you very much, Malcolm. I was struck by two two of his anecdotes. The first was it Lord Cropper who was telling the journalist about the beast's policy for the war? At the Institute, we have no orthodox position on any foreign issue of foreign policy. We have scholars differing with each other all the time publicly in the media that you report on wars and foreign policy issues. So, of course, that idea of an orthodoxy is alien to us, and yet it's beguiling, isn't it? The Institute's policy for the war, it is a bit beguiling. The second one I noted was the charming conversation with Harold Evans, where he warned you off the alternative routes, and it reminds me of a conversation when I was a very young man working for Paul Keating, and Paul gave me some advice about public life. He said, mate, you don't earn much money in public life, but you earn good psychic income. And I think it's not just politicians, of course, who earn psychic income. It's journalists who perform an essential public service for our country. Ladies and gentlemen, we come to that part of the evening in which I announce the winner of the 2014 Lowy Institute Media Award. The winner will receive a generous travel voucher, which is enough to get him and a partner to Asia and back. And we hope that when they're in Asia, they will write a blog post or two for the interpreter, as well as a cash prize of $5,000. They will also win a beautiful trophy. And at that point, my colleague Kate emerges. This is a beautiful trophy designed by Dinosaur Designs, who kindly designed and donated this unique trophy. Louise Olsen herself designed the trophy in keeping with the spirit of the award, and it evokes an eye on the world. So thank you very much. I'm going to leave it there for a minute or two. Thank you very much, Dinosaur Designs. Dinosaur Designs, like the Institute, is an Australian-born outfit with global ambitions, and we thank them very much for supporting the award. Ladies and gentlemen, last year's winner was John Garnaut, who Malcolm referred and indeed quoted from some of John's work. And John is here this evening. And John's reporting from China was ambitious, both ambitious and influential. And we gave the award last year to John for his long series of brilliant articles explaining the Chinese leadership transition in late 2012, as well as breaking news of a dangerous incident in the South China Sea. So thank you again, John, for coming, and congratulations on your win last year. Ladies and gentlemen, this year we brought together again a distinguished panel to judge the award. The panel consisted of former Federal Minister and Ambassador Amanda Vanstone, journalists Chris Masters and Jane Hutchin, Lowy Institute Board Director Mark Ryan, and myself. Thank you very much to Chris, Jane, and Mark for being here tonight. And I'd personally like to thank them and my other fellow judges for the spirit in which they participated in the judging lunch. A tiny bit of background. Unlike other awards, I know there are other media awards out there, they'll remain nameless. I know they have formal nomination processes, which no doubt attract all sorts of professional application writers. But we take a different approach. Our judges, who themselves are keen observers of international affairs, bring to the judging lunch their picks, their top picks of reporting over the 2013-2014 financial year. And the Lowy Institute research staff also contribute nominations for the judges to consider. Each year, the panel judges the award on the following criteria. First of all, topicality, the importance of the issue or issues to Australia's engagement with the world. Secondly, influence, the degree to which the journalist's work informed or shaped public discussion of international policy. Thirdly, originality, the extent to which the work brought attention to a new international issue or idea, or re-examined an existing issue from a new perspective. And finally, of course, quality, the high standard of the writing or the broadcast. This year, ladies and gentlemen, the judges settled on five finalists. First of all, Christopher Joy, who is with us tonight for his coverage of intelligence and espionage issues. Secondly, Hayden Cooper for his foreign correspondent story on Peter Greste. Thirdly, Amanda Hodge for her reporting on sexual violence in India, as well as her expert commentary on the Indian election earlier this year. Fourth, Michael Bachelard, who was mentioned earlier by Malcolm, for his series of high-quality articles on the Indonesian election. And finally, Michael Edwards, for his coverage of the polio epidemic in Pakistan. The judges reached a consensus decision on the winner, and I'm delighted to announce that the winner of the 2014 Lowy Institute Media Award is Hayden Cooper. Hayden's coverage of Peter Grester's trial and his compelling interviews with Peter's colleagues and family demonstrated the personal risks that all foreign correspondents take reporting from countries in turmoil. Let me say, this was always going to be a great story. We were aware of that. But we gave the award to Hayden for the way he told the story. Hayden is reporting from the Middle East, where it seems like the whole region at the moment is on fire, but he was able to record an acceptance speech.
Hello from windy Jerusalem. I'm incredibly grateful to receive this award. I had no idea that I would have any chance at winning it, so thank you. It's also with a touch of sadness because we had all hoped that by now Peter Grester would be free. In fact, we hoped that June the 23rd would be the day that he and Mohammed and Baha would have won their freedom, but sadly it wasn't to be. I promise that we'll keep doing everything we can to cover this story until we do win their freedom. Thanks so much for this. The Lowy Institute is one of a kind in Australia, and I'm a great fan of your work. Also, a massive thanks to the brilliant team at Foreign Correspondent, led by executive producer Steve Taylor and Marianne Leach, producers Greg Wildsmith, Sophie McNeil, and cameraman Jeffrey Lai, and also the editors Nick and Stuart, who worked around the clock to make this story happen on such a tight turnaround. Thanks once again. As I said, it's a great honour. I'm very pleased to receive this award, and I'm sorry I couldn't be there tonight, but things have been a little bit crazy over here lately.
I'd like to invite Kate Tawney from the ABC to receive the award on Hayden's behalf and perhaps to say a few remarks.
Michael, thank you so much. I was in contact earlier this week with Hayden, and he literally thought that all of the finalists were asked to record thank you speeches. For those of you who don't know Hayden, he's an incredibly humble journalist. And for those of you who didn't see the Foreign Correspondent piece, I urge you to have a look at it. And I have had the great honour tonight to sit next to Andrew Grester and to experience firsthand the dignity with which you and your family are dealing with the most harrowing experience. And so this is very much for you. And as Hayden has said, you know, we will continue to cover this story. Michael said at the start of the night, it's a story that we can't ignore. We need to continue to cover it. So this is very much for you and your family. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Kate. Congratulations again to Hayden Cooper. Thank you again to Malcolm Turnbull for his magnificent keynote address. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for this evening at the 2014 Lowy Institute Media Award.